Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Michael Edison Hayden, the author of the new book, Strange People on the Hill. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is my first international conversation since the book came out, and I'm excited about it.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you found yourself, I guess, on this beat?
Yeah, I'm trying to find a version of this story that doesn't take a while, but the short of it is I was in India for about 5 years, which is a weird way to start this. But at that time, I was just a playwright. I had never done anything on journalism, nothing like that. The years were 2010 to 2015. I knew a lot of people from Australia over there too, because there's a lot of expats and journalists and stuff like that. And I stumbled into journalism there because all of the bureaus were just like pulling all their people out, if that makes sense. And it was just a switch to digital and all that. And I wound up going from a person who's a playwright to actually having a legitimate journalism background from India. While that was happening, I wasn't really paying attention to everything that was going on in the States. It was always there in the background. And then I came back in 2015 and the country was almost unrecognizable from when I had left in 2010, largely because of this surge in what they would call, I think, quite euphemistically, nationalism. That's what the Trumpers would call it. And it really is a fascist push across the country. And I started to do breaking news for ABC News. I know you guys, you have your own ABC News, but we have a broadcast, it was one of our major broadcast networks. And they were giving all the mainstream stuff of the 2016 election to people who were not contractors like me. And me, they were like, why don't you just do some stories about Trump's base? And it's interesting because that ended up becoming the biggest story of the campaign, was this huge surge in white supremacist activism. And because of that, I ended up getting all kinds of sources and all this stuff. I ended up breaking a lot of stories about it. And I think the next part of the story is the 2017 Unite the Right event in Charlottesville, where there were there's 1,000 white supremacists descended on this town in Virginia. And they did it in the name of protecting this Confederate statue. And when that happened, I was so emotionally impacted by the sight of that. And also by the woman who was murdered, this Heather Heyer, that felt like I had to do something about these groups. And I started to go from just knowing a little bit about it and writing stories about it to wanting to really do something with the skills I had acquired as a journalist to try to stop this surge around the country.
Mike, the book is called Strange People on the Hill, which could be about a lot of things in modern America, but it is actually about some strange people on a literal hill. Castle in a small town. Could you tell us a bit about this group V-Dare and Peter and Lydia Brimlow?
Yeah, their impact is not only in America, so it's worth everybody learning who they are. Basically, Peter Brimlow, who was himself a journalist, he was working for Forbes and all these other things, was a financial journalist. And he stumbled into, or I should say, maybe he was drawn to, these anti-immigrant messages in the 90s. And I wrote a book called Alien Nation, which was at the time taken very seriously by The Economist, taken seriously by the New York Times and other publications before people started to realize, actually, this is pretty racist, this book. And what I would say the short of it is, He founded a nonprofit called VDARE, which is named after Virginia Dare, who was supposed to be the first white child, English child born in the United States. So sorry. Oh, she's, who knows what could have happened to her, right? Her legacy could be destroyed potentially by all these non-white people who come into the country. And I would say that VDARE, it's best understood by their promotion of the great replacement narrative, which is something I know is big also in Australia and any country that is dominated by white people. It's this idea that non-white people have been exported into the country or imported into the country to destroy the fabric of the country by elites. And it's been very poisonous. It's been associated with so many terror attacks, right? Like this, the Christchurch terrorist in 2019, for example, was one of them. But many mass shootings and terror attacks have been associated with this narrative, this idea that whites are being genocided in their own country by elites, shadowy elites, sometimes Jews. In the case of VDARE, not usually. That's not what they're focused on. They're mostly focused on just non-white immigrants and whatever elites might be shipping them in to destroy the white population.
Michael, you've noted that Peter Brimelow was once a financial journalist and quite a mainstream one from what I understand. But what do you see as connecting the ideas that he was propounding then and his later evolution into an activist with VDARE? What's the connection between the two? Has his rhetoric become more extreme over time, or has the message remained fairly consistent?
I think that the biggest change around Peter Brimelow has been the degree to which his ideas have been mainstreamed in the United States. In 2024, the Republican National Convention, that's when we only have two political parties, unfortunately, in the United States. And one of them is the Republican Party, where Trump is. And they have a convention for them to promote the campaign, and it's just a coming out party for everybody related to Republicans. And you actually had people waving signs at that event that say mass deportations now. They're waving. And I remember turning on the TV. I stayed offline in 2024 because I was so focused on the book. But I was shocked to see when I turned on the television a little old lady in a wheelchair holding a sign that says mass deportation now in all caps, along with all these other people. I couldn't believe it. These were the type of rhetoric that VDARE had promoted for decades and was considered the organization for which I used to work, the Southern Poverty Law Center. They labeled them a white nationalist group because of some of this rhetoric. And now you see the mainstream Republican Party promoting these ideas. As far as the financial journalism aspect of it, it's interesting that you should mention that. I think a lot of people get into fascist ways of seeing, which I would argue, personally, my opinion, that's what Peter Brimelow definitely, from what I can see, that's the way I would describe it. He would not. He calls himself a civic nationalist. Some people get into fascist thinking through environmentalism. We've seen that with, for instance, John Tanton in the United States. He's really the grandfather of the contemporary anti-immigrant movement in the country. He was an environmentalist who became so fixated on that, this idea that like overpopulation would decimate the United States. In the case of Peter Brimelow, it's just an economic, this is the numbers don't add up. The economy is not functional. This will not function with this sort of thing. And then that becomes a way, I think, to justify these views that are, for me, on their face, racist.
So, Mike, those are the strange people. Could you tell us a little bit about The Hill? What happened in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia?
Yeah. The quote comes from a young girl who's working the desk at the inn there. And she said, when I asked them about it, she said, you mean the strange people on the hill? So Berkeley Springs is a little tourist-centric town. It's tiny. And when I say tiny, I mean it's 700 to 1,000 people. That's it. The county around it, Morgan County, West Virginia, is 17,000 people. When you consider how populated the United States is, this is a little thing. It's surrounded by hills and mountains. So beautiful. It's a place where a lot of people, this is very important, come from Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, major cities with a lot of liberals living in them, sometimes New York City. And they'll come for a weekend there. So they'll go bike riding, they'll go hiking, right? They want to have a good time in a place that's surrounded by mountains. They want to get out of the city for a little bit. This is common all over the world. And any place where there's a major city, there are these little rural getaways. And when the Brimelows purchased the castle, they did it because they were so concerned about like Antifa and so forth, coming in and giving them like a really hard time when they would hold events, when they would hold these conferences and type of things like that. And also protesters would call up venues like the Marriott or whatever and say, hey, did you know that there's a white nationalist group coming to do a conference there? Is that the kind of business that you're running? And these places would panic and they would kick BDR out, right? That they wanted to do something about that. And this castle is a 19th century castle. It's this beautiful castle that overlooks this tourist town. So you have this town in where liberals come to visit, and Vidar makes the mistake of looking at the demographics of the town and saying to themselves, wait a second, this place is predominantly white. They overwhelmingly voted for Trump, right? You can see that. And if you can imagine them just looking at this, at that horizon and wanting to move there without considering the possibility that of these liberal people coming to spend money in the town, they didn't put those two things together. And then when they got there, they found that actually some of the business owners in the town rely very strongly on gay couples who come to visit, on people of color, and they completely freaked out because of the reputation that Vidar had. So there was immediately this conflict between some of the business owners who viewed them as a liability to them and their bottom line, because people wouldn't want to come to the town and go hiking and do those things because of the white nationalist group that they were told was there. And that sort of drives the action of the book in the sense that you have these business owners, they may be white, but they don't want to lose all their business to Vidar.
Michael, buying a castle sounds like a very expensive proposition. Where does Vidar get its money?
Well, that's a good question. So in 2019, the only thing we know from, and believe me, we wouldn't if it weren't for the fact that these records are public, because they would do everything they could to keep it. A group called Donors Trust, which bundles together donations, usually from right-wing billionaires or multimillionaires. Two donations, according to Peter Brimlow, came together for about $4.5 million in 2019 to this group. And we don't know who they were, and we may never find out, because he's done everything he could to protect the names of the people involved in this. And essentially, that was like just a massive increase year on year of what they would have expected. And it was pretty much done in order to buy this castle. So they get this huge influx of money to buy the castle. And then you have them in a town where the average income of someone is going to be a fraction of what you would expect it to compared to a city like New York. And all of a sudden they become very big, wealthy players in Morgan County, West Virginia.
Speaking of money, Michael, the book also details your work at the SBLC and the difficulties you encountered there. The SBLC itself is a very well-funded organization. I think you're right that it, in 2025, it generated income in the vicinity of $750 million. Is that correct?
I don't know exactly how much the SPLC has, but I do know that, how much they brought in year on year, but they certainly have an endowment that is close to $1 billion, and it's in weird havens where there's no taxes. So yeah, they're a very wealthy civil rights group. And sometimes you'll hear people on the right who oppose this group call it the Poverty Palace for that reason.
And can you briefly let listeners know about your tenure at SBLC and why that enters into the book?
Yeah. What I would say is that when I went to go visit Berkeley Springs for the first time, I did it because Trey Johansson, who runs the coffee shop there that sort of starts the book, called the SBLC looking for help. They didn't know what Vidar was, and they saw that the SBLC had written about them, and they were lost and looking for help. And it just so happened there was a leadership vacuum in the Intelligence Project. That is the part of Southern Poverty Law Center that kind of labels and maps the radical right. So I With that leadership vacuum, my editor and I were making a lot of our own decisions. And she said to me, she said, hey, why don't you go down? This is what we do. Go down there, write a story, and talk to these people. They need help. So I went and went to go speak to them for the first time. And that's how I was really introduced to everybody in that town. Now, I mention that because I don't know if the SPLC a few months later would have even allowed me to go. Because over the years, from the book really takes place between, I guess the first thing described in it is actually towards the end of 2019. And so it's really November 2019 to November 2024, a 5-year period in the United States. And towards the middle of this, the SPLC becomes very cautious about reporting. They're really giving us a lot of downward pressure. They're trying to keep us from reporting, from doing things, from breaking news about the far right. They become extremely scared of MAGA and how MAGA they're not only litigious, but vengeful. And I became a union steward in 2023, the beginning of 2023, largely to help my colleagues and I get back to doing the work that we came there to do. There's not many people who work for Southern Poverty Law Center who make a ton of money. And when you have a job, we could do nothing and make a lot more money working for Bank of America than we could working for Southern Poverty Law Center. So everybody's there because they're in it for the fight, really. And you just had a whole group of workers who were just getting really frustrated with this downward pressure not to report. So I became a union steward, and I hate to say I was a victim of something, but like in reality, I really was a victim of union breaking tactics, where they were just doing everything they could to get me to try to quit. To repeatedly getting me and calling me into these needless disciplinary meetings and all this stuff. It was really frustrating. But then October 7th happened, and my family on my mother's side is Egyptian with Palestinian heritage as well. And obviously I was extremely distraught emotionally about this. And my colleague Hannah Gase and I both signed a petition for writers that called for a ceasefire and also accurately calls Israel an apartheid state. And when we did that, SPLC, they disciplined me, but they didn't discipline Hannah. And Hannah, I think Hannah's got Jewish heritage, I should note. I think some of it was related to the fact that I was a steward and they were carrying out this union breaking routine with me that they weren't necessarily carrying out with her at the time. But there was also another factor too, which is somewhat a right wing publication that wrote a Zionist blogger wrote this thing where it's just SPLC spokesperson blames Israel for Hamas terrorism based upon that petition that I signed. And when they did, I think there's a lot of unconscious bias. There's a picture, you have a most prominent Arab American employee in the aftermath of October 7th. They're using a picture of Hamas instead of me. It looks like Cobra from G.I. Joe, if you're familiar with that. He's got a rocket launcher and a mask and all this stuff, right? And I think there's a lot of unconscious bias that went in there where all of a sudden they decided to discipline me over that. And I was ultimately, my employment was terminated. And I was able to threaten suit, and they settled very quickly because they really had no case. They had just flat out discriminated against me. It sucks because I actually really like my job at SPLC. I have a lot of criticisms of Southern Poverty Law Center, but they were, for a time, the one place that I could think of that would publish some of the work I did. And I'm so proud of some of the stories that I did before things went south there. And sadly, so much of that had to do with both Gaza and to do with union politics.
Michael, you mentioned it as being one of the few places that would publish some of this work. The beginning of the book, you note that for a time there were a lot of people on this beat. Now, when it seems more important than ever, there's very few.
Yeah.
What do you think is driving this failure to meet the moment?
There's so many factors. So it would be fatuous of me to say, oh, it's definitely because they're afraid of Trump. I do think that is the biggest issue. I think the Southern Poverty Law Center is scared shitless of MAGA. I think a lot of newspapers and magazines that had this type of thing. Now, what's left of those organizations, they're scared of MAGA. They're very vengeful. They are very litigious, and they're unpredictable and they can come down on you at any moment in any possible way. That being said, there are other factors too, and there are economic factors. I think the fact that there are no real, that newsrooms are not making money, they're losing money to AI and that sort of thing. There is almost no margin for error. So those issues around being afraid of MAGA, being afraid of fascism, that's amplified to a really tremendous degree because we've seen, for instance, I've seen things where some of these digital only publications are losing just 75% of their traffic to AI. And how does that happen? It happens because people search and they get AI results. They don't go to the article anymore. So they're writing the article, really, the AI is getting all the advantage from it. So it's a confluence of sort of capitalism feasting on all these different avenues where people got their news, and a feeling of terror around what MAGA could do at any particular moment. And if you don't think MAGA is capable of just randomly suing somebody, even if there's no basis, simply to make their lives miserable, look at how easily they assassinated two people in Minneapolis who will never face any charges. The killers will never face any charges for that. So you're dealing with I think it'll take time. I'm confident that we will get past this moment. I really do believe that. But I do think there's a chance it gets worse before it gets better. And it will take that whole journey to look back and realize just how absolutely insane this moment is and how close we're really coming to becoming a fully fascist country. And we're going to find out a few things in the United States. I know this is a bit of a tangent, but we've got midterm elections. We'll see if we even allowed to what degree we're allowed to vote. But I know one thing, which is that people have seen this stuff and they no longer seem to like it.
Michael, while the site may have ceased publication, I think that was in mid-2024, VDare remains active on Twitter. And I wonder how important has social media been to VDare, and what importance do you think the project still retains in 2026?
Very little. I don't think VDare is a particularly important group anymore. And it's interesting because it's people like us who will remember Peter Brimlow when he passes away. They have no solidarity on the right. They just move on. They just chew up things and move on. They have no sense of camaraderie or anything, it seems like. There'll be some people who miss working with Peter and will mourn his loss when he passes away. But in reality, everyone is using everybody in this world. And right now, the reason why I don't think VDare is particularly important, and I think it almost makes the book much better to think of it in these terms, is that this is really the twilight of its existence is documented in this book, because everybody in the book has a really tough time. Me, the people in the town, and Peter Brimlow. Everybody has a tough time. And if you think about where they were, VDare was creating propaganda in the aughts during the Bush years, the W. Bush years, that would eventually help move the party in such a direction that we would see these mass deportation now signs at the RNC in 2024. In many ways, they succeeded. The influence they had at mainstreaming the Great Replacement narrative, it's so prodigious. It's hard to, it really is quite staggering what Brimlow, I think, was able to do in moving the Republican Party and mainstreaming these racist ideas in such a profound way that it's stirring the events of today. But as of today and what they're doing today and what they're doing right now at this particular moment is going broke, and everybody has moved on. They've really moved on. They'll never be able to compete with Nick Fuentes, for example, and the America First thing. And Nick Fuentes will find a time where his audience begins to leave him. That day will come. Everybody on the right gets chewed up and forgotten. And I think that is, as the book reaches its end, there is a melancholic kind of feel. I think some of the book is funny. Some of it is disturbing, to quote one review. It was a positive review. But ultimately, there's a melancholic feel because everybody loses with this type of ideology, including the people who promote it.
Mike, I think that's a good spot to leave it. thanks so much for coming on the program. The book is called Strange People on the Hill, How Extremism Tore Apart a Small American Town. And if people want to find you online, you are on Blue Sky. Michael, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really awesome.
Andy, that is our program. We will be back next week.
Yep. We'll see you then. Bye.
Kefias are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefia to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefias.org.au. That's kefias.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Don't miss Future Country, the country road and NGV First Nations Commission's exhibition, now showing at NGV Australia. See new work by eight emerging First Nations artists from around Australia who've been guided by esteemed industry mentors to present their most ambitious works to date. From weaving and photography to sculpture and possum skin cloak making, experience these powerful works in this free exhibition, open daily until 13 September. Learn more at ngv.melbourne.
A 3CR supporter.